Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that does its best not to bully our resident feminist Mary Pat. One, because Nathan and I are men of good conscience, and two, because MP, if she were so inclined, could eat us both for lunch, just saying. Bias toward women is a common theme in today's movie industry, not just in headline stories about men being accused of sexual abuse, but in the movies themselves. And two of the movies that we'll be discussing this week explore that theme at length. The first is The Invisible Man, which is not so much about the man himself, but the woman he is determined to either possess or destroy. And the second is Seberg, a look at the life of the late American-born actress Jean Seberg, who was badgered by the FBI for her political views. Finally, we'll give a quick synopsis of Catfest Video, which is a collection of video love letters to our four-legged friends. Let's begin with a bit of sci-fi horror with a contemporary subtext. In most other versions and or variations on the story that H.G. Wells dreamed up way back in 1897, men are at the forefront. They are the scientists, the groundbreakers, and ultimately the villains. In this latest version, written and directed by Leigh Whannell, the man in question remains all that, specifically a world-leading expert on, spoiler alert, optics. But Whannell's twist, which goes away toward explaining how this film got made, is not to key on the man himself, but on his main victim, his ex-wife Cecilia, played by Elizabeth Moss. I say ex because in an extended opening sequence, we see Cecilia escaping the compound in which the two live and succeeding, albeit barely. Then in quick succession, we are told that Hubby is dead, a suicide, and that Cecilia has been given a generous settlement, providing that she meets certain requirements. But when a series of mysterious occurrences, a stove fire, some misplaced pills, a hidden cell phone, cast doubt in Cecilia's mind that her ex is in fact dead, pretty much everyone else begins to think that she's lost her mind. And that, of course, sets things up for Cecilia's ultimate redemption. Whannell, who earned fame as the co-creator with James Wan of the Saw franchise, takes his time documenting all this, his camera at times crawling along the hallways of houses, hospitals, and a massive and scenic cliffside estate before he breaks the mood by engaging in quick, violent episodes. All the while, he focuses on Cecilia, well played by Moss, as she struggles to overcome a horror that even H.G. Wells couldn't have imagined.
Yeah, this movie, The Invisible Man, sort of separates itself into two halves, and the first hour of this movie is this really tight, slow burn that's very much about this woman starting to come apart at the seams after she has let her guard down for the first time in years. She has this massive relief that this person who has been abusing her and gaslighting her for years, as we find out, is dead, and she can finally live her own life without the fear of him, you know, always lurking out there somewhere. And then the second half of this movie, and I think that the schism happens after a really shocking moment of violence that
in
I did
restaurant.
Not see
yes,
coming.
Yes.
And it's a terrific kind of Hitchcockian burst of violence, or a De Palma burst of violence. And then the second half is this kind of loopier action freak out sort of movie. And I liked both halves of The Invisible Man. I think it's a really smart twist on a premise that I didn't think I needed to see again. And of course, this is from Universal, who did all of those old monster movies back in the 30s and 40s, including The Invisible Man with Claude Rains.
James Whale's version?
Yeah, James Whale's version. And they were doing this Dark Universe thing where they were going to remake all of those, and they did that mediocre mummy movie with Tom Cruise. They were going to do an Invisible Man with Johnny Depp, and that thankfully got scratched.
Yes,
because
yeah.
I don't think it would have been as smart and tightly wound as this movie is, because all of the previous versions of The Invisible Man have been at their center, I think, have been about the nature of invisibility, that idea that it can isolate you from everyone else and slowly drive you mad. And in this instance, the invisibility is a weapon right from the beginning. Leigh Whannell and his cinematographer, whose name is Stefan Duscio, who also shot Whannell's last film, Upgrade, which is also a really fun kind of elevated B-movie. They do a really smart thing here, which is they prioritize negative space. So there are shots in this movie where most of the screen is occupied by nothing. And what that does is it forces us to sort of look in the background and see, is the invisible man there? And in a lot of instances, nothing ends up happening. And so that puts us on edge all the way through. And it's so much more effective than having, you know, ooh, that glass is floating in the air like, you know, they did in the old version. So I think this is a lot of fun. And maybe we can speak to the themes of abuse and gaslighting, which I think are really heavy in this movie. I do think that it takes those things seriously. And I mean, maybe you could make the case that it's exploitative of those things, but I don't think it is. I think it actually has something to say about this idea that women are coming forward and yet nobody is believing them because seemingly that abuse was invisible because no one was there to see it. And I think making this movie in that way makes it really contemporary, but timeless at the same time. So yeah, I'm a big fan of this.
Well, much like you indicated, Nathan, I did appreciate the various themes in this film. But for some reason, and I'm not exactly sure why, it did not work for me. So the Invisible Man 2020 version, and I'm really trying to assess why that is the case, because everything that you mentioned, I do not disagree with. I think at some point the tension was such that I became a nerd to it. And that's not good. I mean, you said that you remained tense all the way through The Invisible Man. And I just sort of blanked at some point. And I don't know if it was too intense and I couldn't deal with, you know, the sort of horror of this guy stalking her, even, quote, in death. Mm-hmm. But it didn't work on me in the same way. And it actually should have. Now, I liked when it sort of shifts gears. And it never becomes what I would say is a traditional revenge film in terms of its trajectory, but it does shift at some point. I would also say that I thought that there really was gratuitous violence in this film. I mean, there's too much cutting and bleeding and so forth. I do agree that the restaurant scene was super powerful. Yeah.
And
super
I don't want
shocking.
To tell people what it is.
Because,
no. Right.
Yeah.
But there was something about this that did not quite come together. And then I'm trying to determine, is it Elizabeth Moss, who I generally do like? But maybe I've seen her maybe too much recently trying to do too many different things. And I don't know. It just did not work for me.
Well, I'm going to give you a little bit of a life buoy here, Mary Pat, in saying that if you aren't able to suspend your disbelief, then The Invisible Man, all versions of it, are not going to work for you. I mean, there are scenes in which, you know, people are standing in a room and they're going, is he here? Is he not here? Come on, if you're invisible, you still take up presence. You would be able to tell if someone is standing next to you. So you have to just be able to say—
Is this based on your own experience?
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yes, exactly. You have to just get rid of the physics of it and just accept it for what it is, especially since we're not talking about a classic sense of invisibility, not the way that Claude Rains experienced it. You know, no spoilers, but, you know, we're talking about optics here.
Right.
We're talking about the illusion
technology,
of invisibility.
Right.
Right. So I really like what you had to say, Nathan, about in the classic cases, the invisibility itself is what tends to cause the person who becomes invisible to go mad, whereas this guy, he's mad from the beginning.
He becomes invisible so that he can basically wreak havoc.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That he has not been able to because he's lost control. And so
the invisibility is an incidental.
Yeah.
In
and there are a lot of red herrings in this movie.
Yeah. And I do think the second half of The Invisible Man, which is the more violent half, the more action heavy half, where there's a car chase and there's this sequence in a hallway that involves a series of guns and security guards that come across the Invisible Man. I thought it was very clever.
Yeah.
I do think that if you really, really consider this plot for longer than, 10 seconds, it does start to fall apart a little bit. I mean, again, like you said, we're dealing with implausibility right from the get-go because the very concept.
Yeah, and maybe that is my problem. You know, the one thing I have to say, the setting, especially the house that she shares with
it's all glass
the Invisible
and concrete.
Man.
It's like something out of Parasite.
I thought of Parasite as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Dan said, is that the same place? And so I thought that was eerie. I thought that because it
and
does
nowhere
almost
for her to hide in that
right,
house.
Right. Mm-hmm. It presents itself almost like a prison.
Right. And I think that opening sequence where Elizabeth Moss is sneaking out of the house, it goes on for a good 10 minutes. There's almost no dialogue. She's kind of talking to herself and talking to the dog that lives there. And I mean, the way that is shot, the way that it's paced, it's so brilliantly done. And I think it pulls you into the spell of this movie. And then that spell does get broken here and there because mm-hmm. of those bursts of violence. But I think Elizabeth Moss is the thing that holds all of this together, because there are sequences in this movie where she is being menaced by nothing.
Yeah.
And we don't even know if the Invisible Man is really there with her, or if now just the very idea of that is kind of driving her mad, or
which goes back to the point you made about the larger subtext of this film. If you look for it, there is, will I be believed or will I not
right.
be believed that this is happening
right.
to me?
Well, and I think that Elizabeth Moss is the center of this film, because if you look, I mean, we recognize some of the other actors in the film, but they're not any big names, mm-hmm. really. The success of the film does rise and fall with her performance. And Nathan, I know that you're a huge fan,
yeah.
as you've indicated multiple times.
And I'm much less so.
But you still both liked it, and I'm
yeah.
the sort of outlier here. And
impressed.
It might be the suspension of disbelief issue, because you're right. Yeah. You do have to connect with that, say, okay, I'm going with it, and just let the rest of it sort of cascade over you.
And we talked about this with Her Smell last year, which was the movie that Elizabeth Moss starred in, which I liked a lot more than both of you. But this is another performance that I think is really stellar and will get a completely ignored come awards time. Not just because it's early in the year, but it's also a horror film. But I got to tell you, I think Elizabeth Moss walks away with this one.
And that was The Invisible Man. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Seaberg and Catfest Video. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discuss the latest variation of the classic story of the Invisible Man. Let's now move to something based on real events, the biographical study Seaberg, which tells the story of the late American actress Jean Seaberg, before ending with a brief look at something called Catfest Video. Jean Seaberg was the Iowa-born actress who initially earned fame by winning a talent search, coming in first among some 18,000 entrants to star in Otto Preminger's 1957 film St. Joan. But Seaberg's real fame came a few years later, following her appearance in Jean-Luc Godard's 1960 film Breathless, which made her a darling of the French New Wave. As Seaberg's career blossomed on both sides of the Atlantic, she became involved in progressive politics, aligning with the anti-war and black power movements. Seen as a threat by the FBI, Seaberg found herself under intense observation and the subject of a disinformation campaign, which, along with her personal struggles, eventually broke her. In Benedict Andrews' film Seaberg, Kristen Stewart, who, like Robert Pattinson, has gone a great way since her Twilight days, captures the actress's vulnerability and, perhaps more important, her naivete. My question, though, is simple. Why was Andrews so intent on making an FBI agent played by Jack O'Connell into what eventually becomes a sympathetic character? That decision just seems to undermine everything else the movie has to say.
I also struggle with some of the decisions made in Seaberg because, as you're indicating, I think the focus coulda, shoulda, woulda been on her the entire time. Now, maybe the thought was that what they were able to ultimately glean about Seaberg's life, and, you know, which was relatively short, was such that they didn't think they had a feature-length film to make. But I think I would disagree with that. Now, I liked this movie, and I'm sure other people might feel differently. And I can say that with some degree of assurance, because at the screening I attended, there were only two other people in the theater.
And I was mine, one other.
I was alone in the theater.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So whether it's the subject matter or the immense number of other choices, people are still catching up on some of the Oscar-winning films from last year. I don't know why this hasn't gotten more attention, because I thought her performance was amazing. And she continues to amaze us. And I'm talking specifically about Kristen Stewart. And I think that this was an important sort of time period. I went to a lecture at Gonzaga a few weeks ago, and they were making the connections between the sort of the Black Panther movement and Black Lives Matter. And this historical perspective, I think, was important. The fact that she, as an actress, at one point, she says about her experience working with Otto Preminger, one of the most notable directors of the 20th century. She said, "A man lit me on fire and put me on it." And that was her experience filming St. Joan. And we know that that related to her physical pain and her physical experience, as well as the blatant sexism and harassment that she likely had to deal with in all these different contexts, intercontinentally and so forth. I liked Anthony Mackie's performance. There was something about this that I agree with you, Dan, that sort of took a wrong turn at some point, focusing so much on the law enforcement FBI side in Seberg, I think ultimately was a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that this movie does Jean Seberg any favors by portraying her strictly in this era of her career, because we never really get to know her as a performer or really even as a person.
Brief snippets of her film career.
I think that we learn about her as a political figure and as a victim, and that's kind of it. And I felt like that was almost kind of not offensive, but I don't think that it does her any justice. I also don't think that this is the correct way of exploring 1960s civil rights, because this is just another movie about racism in America that's told through the lens of a white protagonist. At the same time, I think that Jean Seberg's story is an important one, and there are other ways in which you can experience her life and her career. I mean, not only the movies that she was in, but also the recent podcast, You Must Remember This, which is hosted by Karina Longworth. She did a whole season that was about Jean Seberg, and she kind of contrasted it and compared it with Jane Fonda's life
activism
and career, and sort of how their trajectories followed along the same path and then veered in completely different directions. And I think that's a very empathetic portrait of both of those women and a really great deep dive into that era of Hollywood. You know, and then there's also the documentary from the Journals of Jean Seberg from the 90s, which I think is floating out there on YouTube.
Not seen that. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you. It's intriguing. I was having a discussion recently with people about film as the form of presentation to tell these stories. And I agree with you that I think podcasts, as much as I'm a visual person, I think podcasts in some ways have taken the opportunity to go much deeper into some of these stories that are pretty nuanced, because this sort of shines on the different layers of what was happening. And I think that it would be fair to say that Jean Seberg, as portrayed in this movie, was not going to get any Mother of the Year awards.
Wife of the Year awards or whatever.
Right.
I mean,
and so I think that it does bring up that whole issue. Seberg brings up that whole issue of what and how do you use the power of celebrity? And is it ultimately disadvantageous to causes for celebrities to become activists? And should we, give them any credibility? Now, in fairness to Seberg, as portrayed in this movie, and as I understand it, I mean, she did consistently support these causes having to do with civil rights and having to do with racism in particular, with her own money, with her own time, and so forth.
I mean, she was a member of the NAACP before she was famous, so it's not like
this little girl from Iowa.
Yeah, it's not like
it's not exactly like she was a dilettante,
right? Exactly,
or at least completely a dilettante. Let's give her some credit. Celebrities who jump into progressive causes today are much more aware of what is at stake. And back then, we were a lot more naive. Oh, the FBI wouldn't come after me. Oh, well, yes, it will.
Yeah, but I
particularly
also agree,
the J. Edgar Hoover,
right?
FBI.
But the last thing I want to say here is that I totally agree with you that the FBI character here, played by Jack O'Connell, is just a howling mistake. Like,
yes.
I don't know what they were thinking about.
Yeah.
That whole plot line is so
stupid.
It was just like you were saying, we have all these movies in, about the black experience as seen through a white lens. This is a white experience about sympathy for the black experience as seen through the FBI lens. It's like, what the?
Let's say the camera loves Kristen Stewart.
Yes.
She looks like Gene Seberg.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Good casting.
Yeah.
And that was Seberg. Let's close with Catfest Video, which opens this weekend at the Magic Lantern Theater. Catfest Video is a combination reel of cat videos culled from many, many hours of submissions and sourced animations, music videos, and pretty much any cat-related video outlet on the internet. Besides compiling the videos, some of which are too cute for school, the festival is dedicated to supporting those agencies that protect and shelter animals around the world. But MP, you're our resident cat lover.
I am. I'm certainly the cat lover. But having said that, I'm not an aficionada of cat videos. So I'm going to rely on you to jump in if you have something to say, because this compresses all, you know, we see 60 cat videos during the course of this particular CatFest video presentation. And I think that people, one of the appeals of cat videos to people who watch them regularly is they sort of pop up on your feed or whatever, and then you can take, 20 seconds and watch the cat video. So you're sort of immersed in cat videos. I also question whether it's, you know, the best idea to watch this CatFest video presentation in the theater. Sorry, Magic Lantern, I like to give you a shout out as much as possible. But I would have to say, if you watch this CatFest video, if you have the opportunity to watch it at home, you can actually pet a kitty while you're watching it. And our cat, at certain points, just went up and watched it on the screen. So
yeah.
Especially when the cats were pretty vocal, she was very, very intrigued by that.
So two paws up.
Four paws up.
Yeah. Oh,
what are
wow.
you talking
right,
about?
Exactly. Yeah, she's our cat's pretty talented.
Yeah.
But you know what you're getting. But honestly, if you like to laugh, and there are some sweet, sweet moments.
And kitties, little kitties. They're so cute.
Okay.
The art of criticism.
Yeah, I guess Nathan, the dog person, has remained silent
over here.
I like cats. Yeah.
I like cats.
Okay,
and
good
dogs.
To know. Good to know.
And that was CatFest Video, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbender, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discuss The Invisible Man and Seberg. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again try to separate cinema wheat from cinema chaff. Until then, remember these words from the late great writer and futurist H.G. Wells. Human history becomes more and more a race between education and catastrophe. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.